Leading LDS is a nonprofit organization dedicated to enhancing leadership ability and capacity of lay leaders in order to accelerate the mission of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Leading LDS is not owned nor operated by the LDS Church, and any opinions expressed on this podcast do not reflect the views of any specific organization. All donations given to Leading LDS are tax deductible and go towards the support of Leading LDS. For more information, visit leadinglds.org. Welcome back to the Leading LDS Podcast. My name is Kurt Frankham, your host. When a missionary returns home early from their assignment, it can be a make-or-break moment. Unfortunately, there is way too much stigma that surrounds those that return home early, regardless of the reason. Many times, the reason for early release is related to mental illness. And I know every bishop, stake president, and parent listening to this wants to do everything possible to make sure our future missionaries are prepared, also that they have the mental health that will lead them to success. That leads us to our interview today with Alex Whittingham, who served for 15 months in New Zealand before he returned home due to issues related to mental health. We found out about Alex's story when a local newspaper wrote a story about his early return, and since then, Alex has become a fantastic warrior in the battle to destigmatize mental health issues in society and also in church culture. Now, before we do that, I want to make sure that I put a plug in for an upcoming conference. And to do that, I have welcomed back to the Leading LDS Podcast, Jamin and Carrie Ferguson. How are you two?
We are great. Thanks Fantastic. For having us.
Yeah. Now, you guys, Carrie, we focused on your book last time, the OCD Mormon. You shared your experience with OCD and the book that's out there and a fantastic story that you have. But that's led to you putting on a conference. You and Jamin have grabbed the bull by the horns and making this happen. So tell us about the upcoming conference, the details, and why leaders should be a part of this.
For sure. Like you said, after I published my book, I thought, you know, wouldn't it be great to have a conference where people who are suffering from anxiety disorders like OCD or PTSD or just general anxiety can come and learn about care and get, you know, help for their disorders, as well as having a place where church leaders can learn more about these disorders so that they can be able to help people in their congregations who have issues. So we just decided to start it up.
Nice. Yes. Love it.
It's coming up on March 3rd. It's going to be an all-day event at the Joseph Smith Memorial Building. We've brought in both some church leaders in Utah, as well as therapists and experts from around the country, actually, to come in and give sessions all day about dealing with anxiety, different types of treatment, helping children, supporting loved ones, and all sorts of things revolving around different types of anxiety disorders. And then, of course, there's a special panel, Kurt, that you're going to be helping out with, specifically targeting how to help church leaders supporting people in their congregations.
Right. And we have some great people on that panel, including a woman named Karen Redd, who just returned from a full-time mission as the area mental health advisor to 19 missions in Argentina, Paraguay, and Europe.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that'll be a really great tie-in, especially with this idea that you're having on the episode today about, you know, dealing with elders and sisters and missionaries who have mental health problems. She'll be a really great resource, as well as some other church leaders and former church leaders who have experience with both counseling and being anxiety sufferers.
Yeah.
It's really great.
It's going to be a good conference here. We hope that people, church leaders, feel like they can come. We did want to offer a special code for people. They use the Leading LDS code and go to our website. We can give them 20% off a ticket. We know it's difficult for leaders to be able to take time or spend money to get additional training, but we hope for people that do come, it'll be really valuable. There's snacks, there's entertainment, and of course, a ton of fantastic speakers.
Yeah, and I remember many times as a bishop, you know, there'd be various conferences that I would attend, you know, around topics that were related to my service as a bishop, and it's completely appropriate to consider the administration budget of a ward, and that's definitely kosher to do that. And so if price is the only thing holding you back, definitely look at that option. But so where should people go to find out more and to register and to use that code?
Yeah. So our website, the best way to get there is to go to mentalillnessmatters.com. That's the company we put together to do this. If they go to mentalillnessmatters.com, they can click on anxiety disorders and Mormonism there and look at all the information for the conference, as well as to purchase the ticket with that code LEADINGLDS to get that extra discount.
Awesome. And I'm excited to be a part of that panel discussion and have a session focused on leaders. And so if anybody comes that's listening out there, be sure to to let me know and shake my hand. And I'd love to have you part of the big event.
Right. We're excited.
Yeah. And shake our hands too. You know, we're excited. So many people we've met online over the past, you know, kind of year since Carrie's been working on her blog, theocdmormon.com, and preparing this conference. We've met so many people online dealing with these issues. And of course, if anyone out there is listening, we'd love to meet you in person. So please come on out.
Thanks.
All right. Thanks, guys. And now here's my interview with Alex Whittingham. Today, I am in the home of Alex Whittingham. How are you, Alex?
Doing great. How are you doing?
Very good. Well, I'm grateful that you're on the Leading LDS podcast. We arranged this. It happened.
Yeah. Honored to have you here. It's surreal having you in my house. I've been listening to your voice the last few weeks.
Have you?
And to see you here in my house, it's like I'm starstruck.
Well, I don't know about that, but you're the one with the Whittingham last name. So
oh, you got that's overrated.
So you are the son of Kyle Whittingham, the University of Utah head coach. Right.
That's right. And after him and everything.
I remember in my elementary school, my mom was a teacher at the school. So I was always Mrs. Frankham's son. So have you always felt like Coach Whittingham's son? Like that's more your name than Alex?
Yeah. I mean, everyone knows him. And so they kind of just associate me with him. But, you know, I'm trying to break out of that shadow.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, he's a good guy. So it's an honor to be associated.
I bet. Now, you actually played for your dad at the University of Utah.
I did. I just finished up doing that.
Cool. Yeah. And so how does the recruiting your son come? Do you go to your dad and say, hey, dad, come on, do me a chance? Or did he come to you and say, hey, we're interested? Or how did that unfold?
Oh, man. Well, I'd probably say that started after my mission because my senior year of high school, I got hurt in the first game and I was out the rest of the year. And I didn't think I was ever, you know, going to play anywhere again after that. So I was like, just kind of thought I was going to hang it up. And then I go on my mission and the thought of football never really crossed my mind. I get home from my mission and my dad says, well, now that you're home, you know, what do you think about playing again? And I hadn't thought about it for so long. I thought, you know, maybe I should pray about this. Maybe this is something I should pray about. And so there wasn't a lot of whole recruiting from dad. I guess it was recruiting from Heavenly Father. He gave me the answer that, you know, if I had that opportunity, I might as well take it.
Yeah.
So that's how I got there.
Yeah. So you obviously growing up in the Whittingham household, I'm sure football was ever present. And so in high school, it was a thing that you didn't even think twice about doing. You were going to play football.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think mainly because my brother played. I like to be like my brother. I look up to him. And
nice.
He played all throughout high school. And he eventually played for my dad as well. And so I think part of it was just, it was a family thing and also just trying to be like my older bro.
Nice. That's great. Now you ended up as the long snapper. That was your official position at the end, right?
By the end. Yep. Nice. That's where I ended up.
So for those that maybe aren't as familiar with football, what is the role of the long snapper?
The long snapper is the guy who is responsible for getting the ball back to the punter on a punt play. Yeah.
Now on TV, it looks so easy. You just toss the ball back and the ball goes through the uprights.
Yeah. Most guys don't think, the average fan would probably not even notice unless someone messes up.
Yeah. And so what, because you had, I mean, that was a position, it wasn't like it was wide open. Nobody wanted to be the long snapper. I mean, that's the position you really had to work for. What did that training look like to gain that position?
Well, it was the spring, about a year ago this time actually, that, you know, I knew my senior year was coming up. I wanted to contribute to the team in any way I could possible. And our long snapper from the last year had just graduated. So I thought, hey, you know, maybe I could have a shot at this. And so I made the decision to, you know, really try at it. I did it a little bit in high school, but never too seriously. I dedicated all my time to it and worked on it all through the spring, summer, got into fall camp and the season started. And I just kept working at it, worked my way up the depth chart. And by game one, I was able to get out there and snap.
Nice. And I always, you know, they always comes down, those games that come down to the kick and it's easy to, all the attention's on the kicker. Is he gonna do this, right? And we sort of feel like it's all in his hands, but we discount the impact that the long snapper hand has and also the holder. And in my mind, I always think that the holder's got the toughest spot because he's got to catch that ball and then like be very intentional about how he holds it, right? And to me, it's like, what if he just fumbles it and, you know, then he doesn't have a chance to kick, but there's a lot going on there, right?
Oh yeah. There's a lot of pressure that I think people don't really realize. I remember this past season we were playing BYU and there was like a minute left in the game and we were up by six and we were punting the ball and we needed a good punt to, you know, get them back on their own side of the field. And that was probably the most nervous I've ever been in my entire life, was running out there to snap the ball with a minute left against BYU, you know, the game I'd been looking forward to for so long. And it worked out in that game, but there is a lot of pressure on that spot for sure.
Well, that's great. I'm sure that's you'll be able to apply that experience in other areas of life as you go on. So now the reason we are getting together isn't just talk about football and long snapping, but you're pretty active on Twitter and you enjoy Twitter. Yeah. Is that your go-to social media?
Yeah. It's okay. There's good and bad.
Yeah.
Twitter. Right. Yeah.
And posted a tweet. I'm trying to see here. The tweet was, when did you, July 20th, last summer? Does that sound accurate?
Yep. Okay. That sounds familiar.
And you decided to be a little more open about some personal things you were struggling with, right? And from that tweet came in an article in the Salt Lake Tribune about your tweet. And basically, I'll read the tweet here. It says, I came home 9 months early for my LDS mission due to a combination of anxiety, depression, and OCD. I never got help until I was on my mission. And then after, when I was home, I've experienced no worse feeling in the world than a depression and anxiety-filled panic attack. There were times I would have rather have been dead than to continue feeling what I was feeling. It's something that I wouldn't wish on anyone. If you or someone you know suffers from any type of mental illness, please don't be afraid to get help. It can save your life and theirs. So you have experienced and struggled with anxiety, depression, and OCD. How those are just sort of these names that we throw around sometimes in society. But in your world, what did that look like?
Oh, man, that's a good question.
Or maybe let me ask this. When was the first time you sort of recognized it in your life, like, this is different and not everybody experiences this?
Okay. I would say that looking back now, it's easy to see what everything was going on. But, you know, at the moment, I thought I was just kind of very concerned over little things, stuff like, you know, making sure a door was locked like 5-6 times in a row, just, you know, having thoughts go through your head that you just can't really get out. At the time, I just thought, like, you know, that's kind of weird. Like, why am I so worried about this very simple thing? But, you know, now that I know what I know, I can look back and say, oh, yeah, I was having, you know, those kind of obsessive thoughts, even at, you know, a young age of, gosh, back to like 12 years old, 13 years old.
Really? Wow. Yeah. And from there, from being 12 years old and on, do you feel like it got progressively worse?
I would say it was pretty consistent. It stayed at a consistent level up until I got into my mission. Unfortunately, I left on my mission without really taking care of these mental issues that I had been struggling with. I just kind of thought they would go away or I'd be able to tough it out or something. And, you know, being on a mission is very mentally strenuous. As you know, it's, you know, all day long work. There's not a lot of time for, you know, the fun things we get to do around here that kind of take your mind off stuff. And so once I got out into the mission and didn't have, you know, things I could do to cope, I couldn't call my friends or watch a movie or things like that. It just kind of really got magnified and the symptoms really showed up strongly when I was on my mission.
So before your mission, you had these coping mechanisms. You mentioned calling friends and maybe watching a movie.
Right.
Did you, even at that time, did you recognize that this was a mental health concern, or you just thought, I just need to settle down and this helps me relax?
I didn't really see it as a, you know, a concern in any way. I just felt like, I like watching movies when I'm stressed out, but what am I going to do when I'm on my mission? I'm not going to be able to watch movies. It'll work out.
Yeah.
But, you know, it just gets harder.
Yeah. So take us back, you know, you graduate high school. I mean, was a mission always on your radar? It was just something that you always planned on do?
I wish I could say it was.
Yeah. tell us about that. How did it unfold?
Yeah. So, well, first I'd say that I had a great group of friends. I had a lot of friends that were, you know, good, strong members, and they were all getting ready to go on missions. And that definitely helped inspire me to go. But I just felt like, I don't know, I struggled to see myself being a missionary. I didn't know if I was just worried if I would be successful or not, or what my concerns were. But it took me kind of a long time to figure out whether or not I should go. I ended up being one of the last of my friends to go on my mission, my friends my age. And, you know, it just took a lot of praying, you know, thinking whether or not it would be a good thing, and some gentle advice from my dad
yeah.
and my mom. They they encouraged me to do it. They thought it'd be a really good thing. And I kind of got to the point where I thought, well, everyone else is doing it. My parents want me to do it. Maybe I'll just give it a shot. And if I don't like it, I'll just come home. I'll give it a few days. And if it doesn't work out, then I'll just kind of give it up. And I ended up, you know, sticking with it as much as I could. And it turned out to be a really good thing.
Yeah. And so, you wanted to go, but, some encouragement helped and your friends mm-hmm. were going. It was sort of the thing to do. And I'm sure opening a mission call was exciting. What do you remember from that experience opening your call and where was it that you were called to?
Ah, okay. Well, I went to New Zealand, the Auckland, New Zealand mission, which is the best mission in the world, my personal opinion. Nice. Everyone says that, but yeah, no, I was very nervous about, you know, getting the call. And then I love, you know, like island culture. Like I had some Polynesians on my football team. Yeah, they were some of my best friends.
You interact with them a lot, right?
Yeah. Yeah. They're great people. And I was hoping that I'd be able to go somewhere cool. And
that was cool.
Man. And I opened it up and I don't know how much cooler you can get than New Zealand.
Yeah.
And once I got that, then I figured, maybe this is setting up like it's supposed to.
Were you excited you didn't have to learn another language? Or?
Oh, yeah. It's the best of both worlds. Get to go to another country and speak English.
Yeah.
Even though the English in New Zealand is...
It's a different English.
Yeah. It's a little different, but you catch on quick.
Nice. And so you go on your mission and... I remember for me, the first 6 months, especially the MTC, I hated the MTC. I mean, some of my own personal anxiety and frustrations came to the surface very quickly. What was the MTC like for you?
I think about, I'd been there probably 48 hours and before I knew it, I was making a phone call home saying, hey, mom, hey, dad, I don't think this is a good idea. I think I should head home. And they're like, oh, no. You got to stick it out to the end of the week. And if you don't like it by Sunday night, cause I got there on a Wednesday, they said, if you don't like it by Sunday night, we'll let you come home.
Yeah.
Then I said, okay, deal. Yeah. Right. And I was set to come home Sunday night. And then the weird thing about the MTC is you're with your district, you know, you're with the same group of guys all day, every day in a classroom and you just become best friends with them.
Yeah.
And you start out, you know, shy, you don't really know the people, but then people start to open up and that bonding with your companion and other missionaries, just, you know, working towards the same goal with them, that really helped me feel comfortable in staying.
So that support group got you past Sunday.
Right. Yeah. made it past Sunday and made it through.
And headed to New Zealand. Did you bring it up to your district at all? Or was it just that camaraderie being the level of fun you were having that just kept you going? Or did you bring it up with somebody?
Well, I remember the night that I did make the phone call to my parents, the guys in my room, my companion and another companionship, they noticed that I wasn't there. Like it was past the curfew or whatever. And I was busy in the branch president's office, whatever, making phone calls. And it was actually a really special moment to be able to, you know, I finished the phone call and walked back to the room and they were all there waiting for me. They were all awake waiting for me. And they all like gave me a big group hug and we're glad that I was still there. And it was actually one of the more special moments in my life.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. And so it's not that anybody knew while you were gone or where you were, but they just knew something was up.
They knew something was up.
And you needed a little extra love. That's awesome.
Really cool.
That's awesome. So you made it, you said you came home 9 months early. So was that that you made it 15 months?
Something like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Stepping back to when you go to New Zealand. Mm-hmm. And I remember the MTC was really rough for me, but then I went to Sacramento. When I got to Sacramento, it was like compounded that 10 times. Like, man, I can't believe this is happening. I can't believe I'm here. 2 years is so long. Like it really puts it in perspective. What was it like for you when you got to New Zealand? Did that help or did it compound?
You know, kind of hard to say. I think that, you know, the MTC is good because you're around your own guys.
Yeah, you're fine.
Yeah, I like the MTC because you don't have to walk around all day talking to strangers and stuff.
Yeah.
You kind of just hang out with your friends and then you get into the mission field and the work is pretty strenuous and you're talking to people and that was really hard for me getting out of my comfort zone, you know, talking to strangers on the street. I hated that at the beginning, but I eventually grew to love it. But I think that probably in the mission field is where I really saw most of my depressive and obsessive symptoms start to show up more. I think one of the main things for me was, I know that, you know, every missionary comes out and they are worthy as they can be, and they do everything that they can to make things right. And then you start to, you know, learn a bit more about repentance, and you learn a bit more like, oh, maybe I shouldn't have done that, or maybe I shouldn't have done that. And you start to, you know, want to really clean up your life. And I think that happens to almost every missionary.
Yeah.
And that was happening so much with me, even though I could confidently say that I had, you know, made myself, you know, spiritually clean, and I was ready to be out there. That was something that I obsessed over, was if I had missed something, if there was something that I still need to fix. And it was so bad by the end of my mission that, you know, the more I thought about it, I started to make things up in my head like, oh, I must have done this. And that caused a lot of anxiety and a lot of, you know, just frustration, because you're trying your best you can. And these thoughts, when you can't really control them, that's part of OCD. The thoughts just keep coming back. You can't really fight them, and because you don't have outlets, you know?
Yeah.
And that was just something that I really struggled with, was having those thoughts and kind of just fighting within myself of trying to, you know, get a handle on those.
Yeah. And so, and this was, I mean, you credit that to the OCD. Mm. I mean, you were obsessing over how righteous you were, how what you've done in the past. Have I repented enough? Those type of things.
Yeah. I think the word for it, it might be scrupulosity.
Scrupulosity. Yes. Something like this is when I learned, I interviewed, she wrote a book called The OCD Mormon, Carrie Ferguson, and her husband, Jamin. And they're the first one to teach me this word, scrupulosity, where it's more of a religious based OCD. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. And so, I mean, not every missionary that has OCD will have that, you know, version of it, but you know, that's just something that I had. That's the way it showed up in me. And that's, you know, what I had to deal with. But I think that every missionary with, you know, that has mental issues, that's struggling, it's unique to each person.
Yeah. And most missions have this, you know, there's a culture of obedience that it's constantly preached from Zone Conference that we need to be obedient missionaries. And so that sort of, though nobody intended this to happen, but that really piled it on you, right? That he's right. Maybe there's something, maybe I'm not baptizing because of this or that, you know, it's all on me.
Yeah. You know, there's a talk from Elder Holland that he gave in the MTC that where he says obedience is the first law of everything. And it was one of my favorite talks. And I heard that and I thought, oh man, that's a lot of pressure. And I, you know, in the state of mind I was in, I really took that seriously. And if I wasn't up by 6:29 every morning, then my day was ruined. Hmm. If I slept in a minute late, then the day's gone. If I was 1 minute late to anything, it became a really unhealthy way of thinking, is just trying to be perfect, which was just the wrong way of looking at it.
Did you assume every missionary was feeling like that?
I don't think so.
Okay.
For me, I was, part of my frustration was, you know, I felt like I was having so much turmoil inside myself, and I was like trying so hard to be this perfect missionary, trying so hard to baptize. And I would see other missionaries in my mission. I would get letters from my friends on their missions, and they were just so happy baptizing so much. And I thought, are they just more obedient than me? Like, what is going on? And that kind of just added to what I was going through.
Wow. And would you say during that, those 15 months, did it come in phases? Were you good for maybe 1 or 2, 3 months, or how would you describe it? The just overarching time on your mission?
Yeah, I think it mostly came in phases. You know, I'd go throughout the week, and some weeks would be a struggle, some weeks would be okay. And then I'd get to P-Day and I'd be able to email my family, specifically my mom.
Yeah.
And I would be able to open up to her about what I was going through. And that was like a breath of fresh air each week.
Interesting.
That kept me going for a lot longer, I think. And, but there was also, you know, times throughout the mission where, for example, if I became close with a companion and then that companion moved away, that would make it hard, because if I had opened up to them, then I wouldn't have someone to talk to. I remember specifically getting into a new area. That was just my dream of an area. It was, you know, I moved into that area when it was, you know, summertime. People were always outside having barbecues. All the kids were playing in the street all the time. It was just like my ideal place. It was so awesome. And I was happy in that place for about 3 days. And then after those few days of like being in this new fresh place, the symptoms started coming back. And so it would come in waves. Like I'd get in a good companionship, I'd get in a good place, but then it'd start spiraling back down.
So the change of companion sometimes, or many times, impacted you negatively, but the change of area helped? Is that, am I understanding that right?
Depends on the area. Yeah. That area that I moved into was great, and sometimes it was, you know, not the best area. But that's with every missionary, I think.
And you mentioned with your, you know, this, the anxiety that would come when a close companion would be transferred out or whatever, transferred away, or you'd be transferred away. And that's because you would open up to them and kind of see them as an outlet or somebody to kind of decompress with? Is that?
Absolutely. Yeah. I remember my first four or five companions I was very afraid to open up with. And then I had a companion from here in Utah, Elder Law, one of my greatest friends I've ever had. I think I first opened up to him and talked to him a little bit about it. And that helped a lot, being able to talk to someone. And then I had another companion right after him, another awesome guy, Elder Saros from Australia, opened up to him, and he was very supportive. And he was just, it helped immensely having someone to be able to open up with. And then from talking to companions, I eventually talked to my mission president, who got me to a counselor on the mission. And then, you know, meeting with that counselor was really very helpful.
Interesting. And so how do you bring it up with a companion? I'm guessing it's not day one when you're unpacking your bags, like, oh, hey, by the way.
Yeah. By the way, I'm going crazy.
Was there something that would stimulate, you know, you having that conversation?
You know, I can't really remember specifically now. I just knew that it was probably a few weeks into it before I would open up to someone that I would really, you know, kind of build my relationship with them and decide whether or not they were, I don't want to say trustworthy, but I felt comfortable opening up to them.
Yeah. There'd be no judgment there, I'd imagine, right?
Right. How they would react. I was kind of worried how they would react. And if I felt like they'd be okay with it, then I'd talk to them.
Because you want them saying, oh, that's because you're just not obedient.
Right. Yeah.
That's not going to help. You know? Was there any clear like experience during those 15 months, you know, maybe it was when you brought up with your mission president that really stands out as maybe a turning point or something that was really beneficial or just the opposite?
So I think that first getting in to see, you know, professional help, they have LDS Family Services down there, and I was able to go talk to someone there. And, you know, it was nice being able to talk to a companion because they could try to empathize, but, you know, they're not psychologists.
Right.
They couldn't really explain what was going on. And so being able to talk to a professional and help me understand, you know, what I was struggling with helped so much. And at the same time, like, it's kind of funny, as I was starting to meet with a counselor, I started, you know, I was what, 13, 14 months into my mission at that point. And I started to feel like the Spirit was telling me that I had done what I'd gone out there to do. That I had worked really hard for those first 13 or 14 months. And I just felt like my mission was going to come to an end soon. And I felt like comfortable and calm and peaceful about it. Which that was just my experience. I don't know if that'll happen to everyone,
sure,
but that's just what I felt, is that, you know, getting that help, helping the people that I had helped, and then helping myself, I felt like I had served a successful mission at that point.
Nice.
With about half my mission to go. It was kind of weird, but
So how did it unfold? How was the decision made that, it was time for you to have a mission accomplished and head home?
Yeah. So I'd met with the counselor four or five times, and he was in direct communication with my mission president and, you know, giving him advice whether or not it'd be best for me to go home and work on this or to stay out and work on it. And after about a month of meeting with him, he let my president know that it'd probably be good if I went home and got this figured out. And so just one night I got a phone call from my mission president, President Lekius, awesome guy, just said, "Hey, Elder Whittingham, I've been talking to, you know, so-and-so, and he thinks it's best that we get you home and get this stuff figured out." And I thought, like, oh, well, I kind of saw it coming.
Yeah.
I felt
because you had these feelings,
yeah,
right?
I felt okay with it. I thought, okay, well, yeah, that makes sense. And that night was just kind of really surreal, packing up my stuff and getting out the next day.
Wow. It's happened that fast. Just one day you get a phone call.
About 12 hours.
And you're on a plane the next
call
day.
And right into the president's office.
Wow, interesting. So you come home, and I assume you had further treatment, meeting with counselors, and I wouldn't be surprised if that's something that still continues in your life, right? And what would you consider yourself in? Are you happy with the stability in your life, your coping mechanisms? Help us understand that part as far as coming home. And I don't want to say, you know, you've been healed by any means, but as far as managing it.
Yeah. So I came home and started meeting, I think the very night I got home, I went and met, or maybe the night after, I met with a counselor from LDS Family Services again here in Salt Lake and was able to talk to him a little bit about what was going on. And from that point on, I met with him pretty frequently, almost on a weekly basis. And, you know, at that time we were figuring out whether I should go back out or not. And he said, well, you have the option if you want to, you know, we're starting to get this figured out. And I, you know, I'd still felt like I had done what I needed to do. Yeah. And so I just thought, you know, there's no need for that. I just want to keep working on this. And so met with him, met with a psychiatrist, got on some medication that have really helped. And, just, you know, ever since then, through meeting with counselors and being on medication, it's just something you never really cure yourself of these things, but you just learn different ways to be able to handle it. And the medication helps you and, you know, be more stable, and you just learn to live with it and make the most of it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. Going back, let's talk about the stigma that comes with coming home, quote unquote, early from your mission. Right. And I appreciate you sharing that sort of that spiritual experience and impression you received that, you know, your job's done here and you can go home feeling like you served a mission and it doesn't matter how long, right? What sort of experiences did you have battling that stigma of like, oh, you were called for 24 months, not, not 15. So, I mean, was there any of that?
Yeah. So for me, I think the most powerful thing was that spiritual confirmation that I had done what I needed to do. I knew in my heart that I had served a successful mission, but still, you know, coming home and seeing your friends and seeing your ward members, it's kind of like you get the feeling that people are kind of asking questions like, why is he here? What happened? But luckily, you know, I was able to have a few close friends and family that knew the story of what had gone on with me, and the important people knew why I was home, and that's what I tried to focus on. It was easy to, you know, sort of get worried about what people were thinking. And I think that's a very common problem for a lot of missionaries that come home. But if I had advice to give, it would just be, you know, your mission's between you and God. It's not, you're not going out to serve your Relief Society president or the primary teacher. You're going out to, you know, help the people that you serve, help yourself, and to serve God. And to just focus on that the best you can and know that what you do out on the mission field is between you and Heavenly Father. Yeah.
Is there any specific thing that stands out, whether it's something your parents did, something your bishop did, or your ward leaders or friends that really helped you feel welcomed home?
So I remember meeting with my stake president the night I got home, and he was very loving and welcoming. President Stringham, he's an awesome guy. He was there and he told me, you know, Elder Whittingham, we've honorably released you and you have served a successful full-time mission. And hearing that from him just kind of confirmed, I guess, what I had felt within myself. But I had, you know, that awesome stake president. My bishop, Bishop Sterling, was an amazing guy that really helped me, you know, get back into the ward and get back into the swing of things. And obviously my parents, you know, they are awesome. I can't say enough about what they've done for me, not just with my mission, but, you know, my whole life.
Yeah.
And, you know, just that support of, we know what's going on and we know what you're struggling with and we're glad that we can get you help now.
Yeah, that's great. That's fantastic. I'm just looking back, you know, I think from a leader's perspective, I think it's easy for people to hear about these experiences of, and you know, there's been more, the church has been really good at helping the leaders be, ask more probing questions, be more aware of, you know, if there's mental illness present, you know, those types of things. But it sounds like from your story, it's not like, oh yeah, we missed some things, or, you know, Alex wasn't forthcoming about how he was feeling. And if he would have done that, or if we would have asked right questions, we could have avoided this mess altogether. But it sounds like, you know, you went on a mission and it's not like this was a huge mistake that you had to be drawn through. I mean, you appreciate your mission but looking back with hindsight, what do you wish would have been done differently? And what do you think would have happened if that would have been the case? You think they would have just said, well, you know, bless your heart for wanting to serve a mission, but it's not for you at this time? Or what do you think?
Well, I'd probably say, first of all, that I really love my mission.
Yeah.
It means everything to me that, you know, 15 months I spent out there completely changed my life. I was listening to your talk with Chad Lewis, and he mentioned that his mission, it's like BC and AD with his life, before mission and after mission. And I feel that same way about mine. It's like such a pivotal moment in my life. But I know that they have updated the interview questions, I think, now to, you know, include more questions about mental health and all that. For me personally, I didn't feel like, oh, I have this secret illness that I'm taking with me to my mission and they'll never know. I didn't know what it was.
Yeah, you didn't know what to call it or that it was a thing.
Right. I thought I was just kind of a peculiar guy. So I think that, you know, if we had the interview questions that we have now back when I was getting ready to leave, maybe I could have got things figured out and then served for 24 months. But, you know, honestly, I don't think I'd change anything about my mission. The way it went is how it was supposed to be, in my opinion. But I think that what we have now with opening up, asking questions, you know, about mental illness to each missionary helps them recognize, you know, within themselves things that I probably didn't recognize within myself.
Yeah. And I'm sure you're somewhat familiar with some of those questions that they're now in place. But looking back, do you feel like you wish your bishop or stake president would have asked you something, or was there a better way to prepare you rather than just saying my mission isn't an option for you, but to prepare you better so that it wasn't, you know, even if it was still 15 months, that wasn't this, you know, torturous time from time to time. Anything they could have done in hindsight, you think?
I don't think so. Yeah, it's hard to say, you know, hindsight's 2020, but my bishop and stake president at the time, they're wonderful people, and I have nothing but good things to say about them. Yeah, I mean, it's hard for a bishop and a stake president to see something like that with a prospective missionary. I think that it would be good for them to work with the parents and to, you know, get a, you know, second opinion on what the prospective missionary is like, what he's going through, if he has anything they should be worried about. So I think with missionary, parents, and the bishop and stake president, I think if they all work together, then that would probably be the ideal way to, you know, help these missionaries get ready.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. I think that's great advice. And really, I don't think there is a perfect answer. I just, you know, speaking from, I've served as a bishop, and you just sort of, you know, when someone comes home or is experiencing a tough time on a mission, you sort of beat yourself up as a leader. Like, what could I have said? What could I have done? And really there's nothing. And again, I think it's important. What I'm gaining from this interaction is that your mission wasn't a mistake, or it wasn't something like, oops, we shouldn't have sent them. It was a beautiful time in your life, and you changed and developed as an individual. And I think the big thing is if we can just get rid of the stigma of, like, you know, 15 months is still a valid mission.
Right.
And that's great. And to hear that your leaders really reinforced that as you came home, your parents, and that you had a great mission, and you should hold on to those memories as a wonderful time.
Yeah. I mean, hopefully all missionaries can feel that way. I think that's the ultimate goal, is to have, you know, no matter how long a missionary is out, for them to feel comfortable with what they've done and to know that they gave it their best shot, and to not be embarrassed that, you know, they didn't baptize as many or they didn't serve as long as the other guy. And, you know, that's my biggest thing, was just comparing myself to others. I wish no missionary would compare themselves to another one. Yeah. Each mission is so individual and so personal and just unique to that person.
Yeah. I think it's awesome advice. So came up from a mission, and what led to you tweeting about it? You just woke up one day and said, you know what? I don't have anything to tweet about, but today.
The tweet.
Yes. The tweet.
So I think that day, the lead singer of Linkin Park had committed suicide.
Oh, okay.
And it came out that he had suffered through depression all these years. And I mean, within my close friends and family, they all knew what I'd struggled with. But I feel like, well, maybe I could just, you know, say something and help someone somewhere, because this was just such a tragic story that someone would suffer silently for so long with this. And so I just rushed through a quick notes message. I was out right before a lift, right before a workout at the with the football team. I just hurried and typed something up that, you know, I felt like could get my point across, and really came from my heart, and just with the goal of, you know, hopefully someone who needs to read this can see this and know that, you know, they don't have to suffer alone, that I suffered for so long alone, that I don't want someone else to have to go through that.
Yeah. And there's just something in the realizing that other people are, because there's this probably a sense of just loneliness, like I must be broken. I'm the only person that feels this way, and just hear others. And obviously that feeling just tragically leads people to make decisions like taking their own life, that there's something wrong with me. I'm all alone. Nobody will understand. Right. So to have a voice out there that can relate to some degree is probably what you're going for. Right.
Yeah. I think opening up to someone that you trust is one of the most beneficial things you can do. It helped me so much. And I think that should be the first step for a lot of people, is just, you know, open up to someone they trust and being able to talk about it.
Yeah. And obviously the there's an article that came out in the Salt Lake Tribune, but any other response? What was the general response, or did you get private messages, or?
You know, I was getting messages on Twitter and Instagram and people, you know, saying thank you for sharing what you did. And I've suffered through similar things. I know people have suffered through similar things. Thank you for sharing. It means a lot to us. And to know that, you know, my initial intention was to reach someone like that and to just, you know, even help one person. But to have all those messages come in saying thank you for this, it was just, you know, really kind of a special time in my life to see that it had made such an impact on people.
Yeah. Awesome. So let's wrap up with this thought. As you think out of, I mean, there's obviously missionaries right now somewhere that were in these depths of despair that you were once in, that just are experiencing these high levels of anxiety and depression, and bishops as well that just want to help. What final encouragement, what message would you send to them that are in that midst of trial that you once were in?
I would have to say that the main thing I would want people to know is that they're not alone in their suffering, that there are other people out there who have similar experiences. I know for me personally, I felt like I was in the worst spot that anyone has ever been, ever in the history of the world, not just missions, but ever. But it's such a relief to know that the things that I was feeling are normal and are experienced by other people too. And that there is such a network of, you know, people, you know, literally angels on earth that are here to help people, to help missionaries, that all they need to do is to just reach out. And there is an overwhelming amount of support that is there for them if they need it.
That concludes my interview with Alex Whittingham. Big thank you to him for, you know, just being so open, being vulnerable, talking about his experience. And I know I was blessed by this, by his story and by learning from it. I hope leaders out there listening can have hope, have encouragement as you sit down with young men and women who have a simple desire to serve the Lord, that we can be more aware of these things. And, you know, if they do serve for a time and have to return home early, quote unquote early, you know, that's okay. It's still a blessing in their life. And as you can see, Alex looks back on his time in New Zealand as such a huge blessing. And as we mentioned in the beginning, don't forget about the Anxiety Disorders and Mormonism Conference, which is March 3rd at downtown Salt Lake City at the Joseph Smith Memorial Building. I'd love to meet you there. Definitely check it out. All the links are in the show notes, and I'd love to shake your hand and get to know some of the listeners out there. Also, if you haven't done so yet, be sure to head on over to leadinglds.org and check out the two free leadership trainings that are available there. One is our recent leadership webinar, and the other is how to hold a one-hour presidency meeting. These trainings will definitely improve your leadership efficiency and also minimize the time meetings take. Everybody needs help there, am I right? So remember, be a leader and not a calling.
It came as a result of the position of leadership which was imposed upon us by the God of heaven, who brought forth a restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ. When the declaration was made concerning the only true and living church upon the face of the earth, we were immediately put in a position of loneliness. The loneliness of leadership, from which we cannot shrink nor run away, and to which we must face up with boldness and courage and ability.